Keeps me away.
February 4th, 2021.
Go ahead and say.
Howdy doody.
Howdy doody. There we go. Okay.
Should I say what it is that
So Lenny has a topic. Bradley has a question.
Oh.
And then the games will begin.
I have answers.
We know.
Yeah, but we're not going to like your answers. We're not going to like your answers.
But Lenny was funny. He said, when he comes down here, don't say a word.
Because if you do, he doesn't have to shut up.
Yes, exactly. So, Lenny, there you go.
So the discussion I'd like to have this evening launched somewhere in my mind the summer of the 2020 presidential primaries, not primaries, but race, where different people were playing what they called movement of protest songs. And I said to myself, oh, that's interesting. I don't know that I term something a movement or a protest song. But then I heard another one, and it was Curtis Mayfield. It was Move On Up. And I said to myself, oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I always thought that song was more of that era, you know, positive movement, you know, song for the African American community. But then Bradley challenged me, which is an interesting point. So Bradley, what's the challenge?
So the question is protest songs. The challenge is
The challenge is what constitutes a protest song.
Right. So I have strong opinions about the differentiation between protest songs versus non-protest songs, primarily because I spent a lot of time in my teens and 20s in protests, attending protests in D.C., in Iowa, in Michigan, and all over the country, because I used to hitchhike to the protests wherever they happened to be, in L.A., and it's interesting because if you get a big crowd of people, let's say, you know, 100,000 people or 50,000 people, or even 1,000 people protesting, they can't sing.
Right.
So songs that are to be protest songs end up being, let's see, Kumbaya, All We Are Saying Is Give Peace a Chance.
We Shall Overcome.
We Shall Overcome.
Well, are those protest songs or are they movement songs?
Those are protest songs. So these are all protest songs. What's interesting is that everything else to me is a social commentary song. And we're talking about social commentary, and so on the cusp of protest versus social commentary is Country Joe and the Fish, Fixing to Die Rag, because a lot of people can sing the chorus, but there's no way they're like immediately just falls
one,
apart.
Two, three, what am I fighting for?
Exactly, they're done.
I was singing that to Walden in the lobby yesterday.
But so if you talk about, you know, what I'll call some of the fathers of what I'll call that genre, mm-hmm. You know, the Woody Guthrie,
Pete Seeger.
So let's
Bob
stop
Dylan.
There.
Yeah.
So let's start. Right. Let's start there. Then we'll move to Bob for a second. There is, in my mind, no question that they not only had a message, but they typically were protesting the treatment of farm workers, the treatment of Mother Earth, the treatment of the objection to some approach that somebody was handling somebody or something, and they felt that they could voice it out there, and in my opinion, did a great job, you know, whether it's Woody or Pete, to do that. Now,
and those were the late 50s, early 60s.
Early 50s, even.
Yeah.
Early 50s. You know, because actually, maybe even late 40s, you know, right at the end of World War II, I think, is where you saw what I would call the arc of that, of those statements from coming out of World War II and people were coming back from the war, and everybody thought, oh, life is wonderful, life is grand, America's grand, and...
Well,
and
Woody was writing in the 20s and 30s
right.
because of the Dust Bowl. And,
correct.
And so he started writing and well, collecting folk songs and writing songs about the people that he was sharing railroads with and radio stations
the
share, with.
The flight of the sharecropper.
And the sharecropper. And he was writing, and there wasn't necessarily a movement, but there certainly was, he was a lone voice really
early. Right. And so that thread that we'll say started with Woody and really hopped on the bandwagon through Pete, who, you know, paid homage so many times to Woody, you know, really created, if you would, the early belief in Dylan as the new voice of that, where, you know, Blowing in the Wind as one, mm-hmm. you know, that people talk about a lot, and being the sort of change statement, you know. But was Blowing in the Wind a protest song?
Well, or
was it a commentary song? So that's what I'm saying. So everybody talked about it. So this is where I sort of get wrapped up in these things.
And Dylan, I will admit I was watching a documentary on him talking about it. He didn't want to be associated with protest songs. He didn't want to be associated with the movement. He was, in his own words, just commenting on the social atmosphere of the time.
Right, so a social commentator.
So, but the fact is that the movement, the anti-war movement, the anti, you know, whatever movement, picks up those songs and say, this is, you know, so it was one of the first songs I learned how to play on folk guitar, because, you know, you go into a movement, you got to take your guitar with you, and then you sit around in these little settings where you got people all around you, and you're playing, you know, Blowing in the Wind, Masters of War. There's so many songs he wrote that were picked up by the anti-war movement, you know, the peace movement.
So there's two pieces here then. So there's the writer of the song itself said, this is going to be a protest song. And then from what you're saying, the people that are listening to that song say, we're going to turn this
into
a protest song.
And so that was where I was going to go next, which is when you look at what happens through the Vietnam War era, the growth of the voice of the African-American people, whether it was the Stevie Wonders through Motown, the Marvin Gayes of Motown, you know, the Inner City Blues, right? Makes me want to holler, right? What's going on? The whole commentary of what's going on in the ecology and everything else. Stevie Wonder, living in the city, is living in the city the plight of a young black man who goes to the city only to discover that being a young black man in the city, it will be taken advantage of, will get arrested, will get profiled as a drug dealer, and therefore he gets arrested at the end of the song just for standing there because the guy says, hey, wait a second, hold this. Run this across the street.
So again, I think that all these are social commentary songs.
I would say Living for the City is a social commentary song. It's not necessarily a protest song.
But, I don't know. I think that, but I think Inner City Blues or What's Going On.
No, I don't think either one of those protest songs either. I think they're social commentary songs. It's just the way that I think that, for what it's worth, it's a social commentary song, not a protest
Ohio.
Song. Ohio? Ohio, again, is a social commentary song. And Chicago, you know, Won't You Take Me to Chicago,
right.
You know, is a social commentary song. Because it was actually written after the events that was talking about.
But these songs get turned into by people. Into a protest song, so this is in the eyes of the person who wants to, claim that in their own way and their own voice such that they believe that they can co-opt it. That was the word I was looking for. By co-opting it, they in their own mind start to change it, right or wrong. So I'm not. It's not that I'm disagreeing with you.
So I think there's a body of work, which I'll call, you know, anti-war songs. And that includes everything from Blowing in the Wind on the very, mm-hmm. you know, on the edge of that, Masses of War, certainly, mm-hmm. you know. And then you've got all these, you know, Fixing to Die Rag. Mm-hmm. You got very direct anti-war songs. You have these other songs like, I can't remember the name of it, from Jefferson Airplane. It was about...
Volunteers.
Well, there's Volunteers, but there's also this very little odd one about some guy playing with his tank, and it's like... It's,
oh, yeah, yeah.
I can't remember the name of it, but... it'll come to me. But there's all of these songs that fit into this genre of anti-war songs. Now, does that make them all protest songs? Or is that just part of this new genre that when they are written, there wasn't the genre yet. They were written because they were making social commentary of the times. And then 10 years later, we say, those were all, you know, protest songs.
So let's fight the power. Let's fight the power.
NWA?
No, fight the power... Isley Brothers.
Oh, yeah.
I just forget about it. The NWA's later on, but
right,
when the brothers came out with Fight the Power, when James Brown came out with Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, are those protest songs because they were proclaiming their power, proclaiming where they were going, or was it some transitional work, as you say, written in the eyes of the writer were one thing, in the eyes of a listener was another thing, and then if you look at that 2020 look back lens becomes yet a third thing, which is what I said, you know, the, you know, move on up where you know, I thought it was awesome that they bring out Joe Biden and Kamala Harris to, you know, to Curtis. I mean, come on, what better way for, you know, for the world to, you know, to come together on that one, but. Is it a political song? Come on, guys.
Well, you know, so respect.
Yes,
is not written,
but not written as written as a sign of power for women.
No, it's written by a guy.
Yeah, but
okay. So now it's written one way. It became popular as a song of power for women. So it's like. So is the song, what is the song? So obviously it's a very powerful song. And in the women's movement, it's a very powerful song. But the question is, you know, it's co-opted. Okay, I'll buy that. It was co-opted by herself.
You know, I Am Woman.
And I Am Woman. There's another
I Am Woman, Helen Reddy.
We Are Family. So all of these songs are in that genre and were really huge in that era, and so you think it's all women's songs. And are they protest songs? Are they commentary songs? Are they just part of a, as you put, movement songs? There's a movement going on in America, so they fit into the movement. But are they protests? Or
they fit into the narrative of the time.
Exactly, and I think the narrative might be "quote unquote," protesting the power of, you know, whatever they're.
So I could take a song that was written for something totally different, and if it just happens to be this time, it becomes a protest song. But then it becomes what it was originally.
Well, that's my perfect example of that is the you know, For What It's Worth turned into an anti-war song, and it was about not about that at all, but it was about some police crackdown, curfews in Hollywood for, you know, a bunch of, you know, kids that, you know, had nothing to do with anti-war or anything else. It just happened to be a curfew issue. But it sounds like if you play it back in an anti-war situation, oh, it's all anti-war songs. Like,
well, again, you know, you can listen to lyrics or listen to, and then you filter it in your own lens. But, you know, so Bradley mentioned N.W.A., Fight the Power, mm-hmm. you know, and that whole genre, you know, F the Police, you know. And I see those not as protest songs, but movement songs. But yet someone else will certainly see it as a protest song.
Right.
And and not a social or a social commentary song. I just think of it like, okay, that's a commentary of that era and what they were feeling because they were discriminated against. You know, they were taken advantage of. They were coming into Compton to kill them, blah, blah, blah.
So you talked about, you know, ghetto songs. So the question is Elvis Presley in the ghetto?
Yes.
A protest song?
A commentary song? A commentary song?
It's a commentary song. I think it's a commentary song.
Because it's like, you put that next to Stevie Wonder, you're like, well, they're both ghetto songs.
Yeah, but it's why did Elvis record that song? That's right. I always tried to figure out, like, what was the behind-the-scenes story, and maybe I don't know, and maybe you do, of why that song was, and who actually wrote that song, and like many things, did Elvis sing it because somebody else wrote it?
In his early career, he had a lot of gospel.
Right, absolutely. So
this was a return to his, he was trying to capture, and I remember reading this, I'm not sure, I find sources or something, but there was a, he'd gotten so into the rock, you know, thing, and then he came back and said, I want to do some gospel. And this was his entry back into gospel.
Guess who wrote In the Ghetto?
Guess who wrote it?
I don't know. That's what I'm asking.
I don't know.
Mac Davis.
Ah.
Which is well, there very you go.
Interesting. There you go. That's interesting.
That's very interesting.
And he didn't record it. Elvis did.
You know, looking at this here, it says it was recorded by Elvis Presley and written by Mac Davis.
Yeah.
So it was interesting, you know, when before you went off on that, when Lenny was talking about this today at lunch when we came down, I went back and I looked up. It's like, show me all the protest songs of the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. And you look at them, you go, oh, yeah, I remember that one. I remember. But you look at it, and you can see the moments of the day as it progresses across. So in my opening statement, from the 40s and 50s, you had about the farmers. Then you had about the war. And then that kind of moved into the ghetto movement or the people of color movement. And then you have the ecology. And it's interesting as you watch the calendar go into the 80s and 90s, what they're protesting. And well, Ronald Reagan was a huge one, too, in the beginning.
There was it's interesting because the 60s certainly had more movements than perhaps any decade in our lifetimes. And primarily because the post-war kids, the baby boom, hit their stride in the 60s. And so there's this massive young people's movement that had lots of varied interests, you know, women, black, ecology, the anti-war movement. And so then there was
literally the baby boomers starting to come of age.
Right. They were all coming of age. And music was coming of age at the same time. So this is a very interesting thing.
Well, the true mass marketing of music
hit
at about 64, 65.
Right.
To the extent of which there were so many radio stations playing what they considered top 40 or a different type of top 40 because Billboard had multiple playlists of top 40 country, top 40 R&B, top 40 pop, or you know, they didn't even call it rock and roll yet at that moment. They call it, you know, not contemporary, but I forget what the label was that they used, top 40 hits or something like that. And like I said, each one had a genre over here, but where now today, if you were to say, I mean, one could argue that when Bruce wrote Born in the USA, right? And here's a song written for one reason, co-opted for another reason by somebody who didn't believe in what he was singing, but just believed in it because it said USA and Born in the USA. So they shout about that. Where are these songs today? That's, I guess, my closing question about this. Where is it now? So we've reached the 21st century, and who are those voices today?
Well, there are a lot of social commentary songs still continuing on, certainly. And if you looked at David Byrne's latest production.
The play.
play. It's not really a play as much as it's a musical production that has him singing and 12 musicians on stage. Every song is social commentary, and it was designed specifically to be seen as a play for a 2-hour, 1.5-hour production, and it's very well choreographed and scripted.
I would argue with you that David Byrne is not a new voice of the 21st century. I mean, I love David Byrne. You know that. And I think that David Byrne is one of the more talented leftovers from the 20th century, still actively out there and doing stuff. But I'm looking at the people who are out there today, besides R.E.M. from the, American Idiot and all of that and taking that. But I don't know that there's – I know they're out there.
So I think there are out there, and I think there's lots of people still singing songs that way. I think that the biggest issue is that we, as an industry, musical industry, we are so we're no longer market centric. So and I say that because of the way the internet and people don't buy CDs; they download individual songs and they hear about songs through the internet, not through our, what would be old school sort of marketing, efforts by music companies or things like that. So we hear about David Byrne because he hits all sorts of media. We hear about, other big names from the 20th century, musicians that started in the 20th century, because they already have big names. New people, you only hear about, my 27-year-old daughter might tell me about five people. Well, of course, Dad, don't you know these guys? No, I've never heard of them. Where would I have heard of them? Oh, well, if you had just listened to this podcast or this Spotify or this or this that. And so you have to actually be keyed in an internet social fabric way to hear about new people. And I think that's something that old fogies like me have a much harder time catching up with, just because it takes a lot of energy just to work, let alone spend time.
I know for us, simply going from AM to FM.
so that's why I know that I share with you guys a lot NPR Tiny Desk concerts.
Right.
And they do a series called All Music Considered, and a shout out to those guys because I think they do a phenomenal job, the whole team. But I will say that I didn't learn about Tiny Desk concert and All Music Considered till I listened to it with my 34-year-old daughter. Happy birthday, sweetheart. And it is an interesting way because I remember being on and I was thinking about this today when I pulled up Tito Puente, Bradley, and you and I were talking about that the first time I heard Tito and Charlie and Eddie Palmieri was when I was 3-year-old with my mom, playing all the Cuban music that she grew up on and stuff like that. And I think that what you then provide influence to your kids on the music that you play in your house, the best thread of this is when your kids become those educators and open your eyes to the next part of that music.
So I'm going to brag a little bit, but one of the things I figured
you
out...
You are going to brag?
Yeah, just for a minute. It was a great idea on my part. Christmas presents to dads are often pretty awful. You get underwear and ties and socks that you don't need, and it's like this, and you do this over and over, and you get this year after year. I finally asked my kids when they were about 12 years old, give me the gift of your music playlist. I don't care what it is you're listening to. And I got some of the worst playlists, I'll just say. But I got music I had never heard of and bands I had never heard of before.
Were there any protest songs on there, though?
Well, I will say there's some surprises. My daughter, I remember her asking me at one point, have you ever heard of this band called The Cure?
It's the feedback loop.
It is they discover things that I've known for, 30 or 40 years or something. They say, oh, this is great. On the other hand, they're introducing me to people I've never heard of before. And yes, there are protest songs on it, and there are social commentary songs on it. And you get those scattered in between, you know, Britney Spears, which I will not say is a social commentary song or artist, but, you know, you get it sprinkled in between all this other stuff.
What would be an interesting question to your children would be, these are great. I see there's social commentary and I see there's protest songs on here. What do they think they are?
So,
and that falls back into that eye of the old beholder piece, you know.
So the real question is, when do we do the phoner in a part of the show, when we get the people to dial in, Mr. Producer, and they're able to actually...
But you know, there's...
Because I want to open up the mics to the phones right now. And yes, you're from Chicago. Thank you, Larry King. God rest your soul. You're from Chicago. Go ahead. Caller, do we have you? Hello, do we have you? Oh, wait a second. We better move to number two.
It would be interesting to... You make an interesting point there to get a guest spot in here with a couple of people that we know who listen to the younger music and have a round table on that one with a couple of subjects. And protest songs would be in there, definitely, and social commentary would definitely be in there.
So, you know, let's just cap this by saying that the protest really shaped that song.
I think and learned that later on, or early on.
What was that?
I said, I think you learned that early on.
Yeah, well I don't know.
You've had conversations about that.
Yeah, but I think that it there are people who, it's sort of like, when does a good baseball player quit? You know, they should, theoretically, quit when they're at their prime and they're at their peak and they know they've really only got 2 years to go and they need to move on. But there are guys who never recognize that, and they go on and sing or play or try. And there are guys that go, no, that's not me, but I can be that.
All they have to wait is they stop playing, wait 10 years, and then join the oldies tour. And then they don't care anymore how well they play.
Exactly.
I'm just saying.
And they can do their own stuff, too.
Yeah, and they can do their own stuff.
Is that Peter Frampton? I'm sorry.
I don't want to go there. So there's a real interesting trend in, as you pointed out at the very beginning of this, where some bands later on in their career will put out covers of people they enjoyed.
Right.
And so I some of those are lousy covers.
And some of them are great.
And some of them are great. And you know, I'll point out one that I'm particularly not fond of, though I love the band. You know, Blue Oyster Cult did a Steppenwolf cover.
Ouch! That hurts.
And they even laugh about it. But you know, it's on their, you know, it's on one of their best hits albums, which I'm sort of like, really. And I think they just enjoyed doing it. They just enjoyed doing it because they paying homage to it. You know,
one, which you know, so you know the. The Tony Bennett, you know, kind of, I'm going to take a song that I love by you, Miss Artist or Mr. Artist, and I'm going to record a new version with me singing with you, perhaps to a new arrangement. I know he did it like two or three albums.
Matt King Cole.
I mean, oh, yeah.
Well, so Frank Sinatra made a career out of singing Billie Holiday. And old blues standards,
I mean,
and just bringing them into big band, major productions with his style, as you pointed out, the production and everything else goes into this. But Frank could turn an old song, which is a great song,
just a moment on Frank. So Frank, there's a great two-book biography that each book has got to be 1,200 pages. And it's literally the ultimate biographical tale of Frank Sinatra. But I think it's also the only book that I've ever seen that really comprehended Frank's real skill as a musician. Not as a singer, but as a musician. He was a consummate musician. Nelson Riddle and Quincy Jones quoted in that book, talk about the fact that he could see through the song into the arrangement and hear where the trombone or the saxophone or the strings needed to come in, and that's not just a singer. That's a consummate professional who comprehended the structure and the strength of the song that was written and that was able to take that and, as you say, Walden, made it his own.
Right.
I mean, it was incredible.
Those skills you find in producers that aren't necessarily singers. I mean, what he did is he brought in skill sets into the studio that were much wider than, you know, I'm a singer, I got a band, you know, I'm a singer in a rock and roll band.
Right.
but by bringing all those skills together and being somewhat of a dictator in his...
Where he had to be.
Which he had to be. And you find that James Brown had that same sort of tendency, right? You know, and David Bowie has that same, you know, there's a handful of people that have that skill set that crosses production, music, talent, and by the way, they're great singers, and so they put it all together in a package.
I challenge you to name more than 10.
No, I don't think there are.
I don't think there are. I think that you have, as you mentioned, Frank was certainly one of them. James JB was certainly one of them. Michael Jackson, you know, people don't recognize the qualities of his musicianship and his ability to see a person from a stage presence. And his last documentary that he did, I think it was called "This Is It."
When you watch
him through that documentary, how he so controlled the staging, the concept, where he wanted the guitar player to stand, not a little, forget about play, where he wanted him to interact with him and how he wanted to interact with him and what he wanted to bring out and what he wanted to do with the dancers to accentuate a point of a beat.
Right. So he brought a different aspect to performing because he was bringing in choreography as a choreographer, and he worked with professional choreographers as well, but he had his vision that he brought to
Absolutely.
It.
Prince.
And Prince is another Prince. who was somewhat of a dictator in the studio, but for good reason because he brought so much to it. But there's a handful, and maybe there are 10.
I don't know if we can go past.
But what that did, though, was make for a great cover song.
So
because they, like you say, with Frank Sinatra, Perry Como, I mean, all the crooners of the
they could take someone else's sheet music, someone else's words, and change it in such a way that you forgot that
the original was there.
Yeah, or it was so different. Was so moving that you go, oh, yeah, that was okay, but that, holy crap.
Well, I like covers, and I'll say Frank does a lot of those, that they're so good that I love Frank's version, but I equally love Billie Holiday's version or somebody else's version because they're different. They're so different. It's almost like we have
well
two
done.
Different songs. They're both great. And there's that's a great definition of a great cover song is that someone made it their own to the point that it stands by itself. And I'll say Bobby McGee is a great example of that as well. There's a number of them. I mean, that, you know,
Sinead
O'Connor's Prince cover is better than Prince's. I mean, it's better than Prince. I'll buy any day of the week. I'll say, you know, so there's these.
I'm sorry, no one compares to Prince. Misquote a song.
I thought that was no one compares to you.
Yeah. Well, like I said, to misquote a song title.
Right, but I'll say, you know, that level of doing a cover is, I mean, when it gets to that point where you and I can debate about it, but it's we're talking about how good the cover is and how good the original is.
There's no question there.
So is there a formula into a cover?
No.
That's so some covers are so identical that they shouldn't have been done. And they're fun to do. I mean, they're fun to play. Don't get me wrong.
They're almost a tribute song.
Yeah, it's almost like a tribute, right?
Or a tribute band.
A tribute band.
So there's a difference. So one could argue that a tribute band may not be a cover band.
Oh, I'll say they're a cover band, but because they don't actually, no one's going to buy a Brit Floyd album, right?
Well, remember the Beatles 64?
Right.
The whole, you know, Back Doors.
There's, you know, a number of these cover albums.
Dead Zeppelin, you know. Yeah. And then there's
I will say there's that, was it Dred Zeppelin?
Dred Zeppelin. Yeah.
They actually have albums. And Jesus Presley has albums. And they do these sort of reggae, Led Zeppelin, Elvis Presley.
Okay, but I got one for you.
So not only do they cover the song, but they change the genre.
But I got one for you that's sort of like that as we morph into it is Al Yankovic.
Al Yankovic is
a talented, skilled individual who could see from the original what he could take and change it.
That was going to be one of my first questions. I have a different topic for a different day about parody.
Okay.
And humor,
right,
songs. And Weird Al is my
parody and humor.
He stands alone.
Right.
So well.
But he's almost a skilled musician.
And he's a great musician.
Right.
But he's a genre unto himself at this point. We should say this during the day, but in the early, there was all these novelty songs in the 60s. And we forget about novelty songs. There was a whole era.
The Monster Mash.
Who's that little doggy in the window?
He was a blue-eyed, purple people eater.
Right. That's a whole different discussion. But
do weird, I have to play a copyright for that?
I don't know.
Weird Al, you know, grew out of that. And I want to...
Yeah, very early on. Yeah. Very early
but
on. But
let me ask you this. While we're on Weird Al, and I don't want to go down the parody trope, because that is a different set. Did he start off as a cover artist?
Oh, I'm sure he did covers in his band, you know, in the garage. But his weird, you know, like...
His Weird Al-ness.
Like, a lot of people do this. They listen to the radio
and make up their own words,
you know, like, oh, you know. And it's funny, but... He made a career out of it. I mean, some people can do that.
There's a documentary out on him where he kind of goes through and diagrams how he got into doing that. And then with the accordion and the whole nine yards.
It's a puppy pizza polka.
Yeah.
I definitely think we have another 60 minutes to that one.
Right, there's another topic.
So we're going to do the Welcome to the Weird Al Yankovic Hour.
It's the Dr. Demento Hour. I mean,
Dr. Demento, there you go.
There's an interesting guy.
So that's another thing.
Yeah, another thing. So in conclusion on cover bands, the question really is, as an artist who's now emerging today, do people still start out as covering other stuff?
Or are they writing their own original stuff?
Well, so this is an interesting problem because I want to say there's three issues I see in sort of the history of recording stuff. And one is when you start in the 50s and the 60s, you could record everybody's stuff and only have one song that you wrote on it, you know, and that'd be fine. Somewhere around the time that Bob Dylan changed music by being the singer-songwriter, there was a movement by record companies, we need more original songs.
But that's funny because a lot of people covered Bob, including Jimi Hendrix.
Oh, of course. And All Along the Watchtower is one of the best covers ever because it's so
different.
It's so different, yeah.
You know, so different and iconic by itself as opposed to, you know, of course, Bob's, which is also iconic, but just, you know, completely different. But
was that a good, by the way, a protest song, All Along the Watchtower?
It's an interesting
It is,
point, yeah.
But it's also a drug
it's a social,
song.
It's a social commentary song, too.
You know. he has social commentary about Alice in Wonderland.
Exactly.
So the there's this movement towards becoming everything being written by your own band, and there's always the Linda Ronstadt's on the side, and there's the all and the Monkees that didn't write any of their, you know, these sort of all these other bands.
One of Walden's favorite bands, by the way.
They wrote one song. Actually.
Oh, they actually wrote a number of songs on their fourth or fifth album.
Yeah.
But there's a movement. While there's certain people that are so good, like Linda Ronstadt, that they don't have to write their own, they just arrange other people's songs and do
because they can own it.
Because they can own it, right? So there's always going to be those. And Barbara Streisand's a great example. I mean, there's so many people that do that well that it continues. But the main sort of energy of rock music is write your own stuff. Now, and that is great when we had a 40-minute max vinyl album. When we moved to CDs, I think music suffered tremendously initially because there was a push. You need to have 70 minutes now or 65 minutes. And they didn't have 65 minutes of good music. Now, what they didn't do, though, which is interesting, is then supply cover song. I mean, they could have done. I mean, a lot of these bands, you know, you see.
So you think CDs helped the cover music movement?
No, they could have helped it.
They could have if they would have been smart here.
Right, because.
Is what his message is.
That's exactly right. And so, but now, you know, 20, 30 years later after the CDs came out, or 30 years later after CDs came out, you're seeing CDs filled with interesting, you know, extra music, like an extra
unrecorded tracks,
unrecorded tracks, live versions. But again, I would say this is a great opportunity to put in some. You know, we were in the studio. I remember watching Yes actually live, and they did three Beatles covers in a encore, and it was brilliant. And I was just like, wow. You know, I didn't expect that.
So Joe Jackson, in concert, always throws in a Beatles song,
right?
And some other. I heard a Donovan song one time. I mean, he always will throw in something from that era that he liked, or a jazz song that he liked, and you go, oh, that's kind of cool.
So that's what. I'm beginning to see more of the older artists like Joe, you know, doing covers in concert. But it would be nice to see them do nice recordings of those too, and mix them in with their original music, because it's nice to hear great productions of good cover songs.
Yeah, but nobody goes to see Nathaniel Rayclif and the Night Sweats.
Everybody goes to see him.
No. Or the Revivalists to go hear them cover a Beatles song. Except if they were cool, and not that they're not cool, and it's not a slight to any of them, if they were cool, they throw in one or two in an encore just to, you know, because they've played all their hits, they've done all that, and now they need to come out with something extra. So instead of saving that one song for the encore, they play their songs, and then they come out with those one or two. I always love this song by blah, and we're going to play it for you today.
But you brought up an interesting factor with Joe Jackson. Did he do that in his early days when he was building his brand?
He would. I saw him throughout. I've seen him throughout his career. And there were certain moments in certain concerts, particularly when he went from the rock genre to the jazz era of Joe, then back to the rock, and then to the jazz rock classical moment where he is now, where he would take something as a bridge to another song, and as he would do that, he would throw in a part of
a Beatles song.
A song. So yep. I remember there's on a live cut I have where he breaks into Ramsey Lewis in the In Crowd. And it's like, where the heck did that come from?
But
when it was so freaking cool.
But that's kind of bridging it in. Whereas if I'm trying to build my brand when I'm young, I'm not going to do somebody else's songs.
So,
but as I get older and my crowd matures,
well, so,
then I have some space to do that with.
No, I disagree.
So let me throw in two different sort of punk era bands that did interesting things. So, you never guess, Patti Smith.
I thought we could almost get through a podcast without Patti Smith.
No, you can't. So she actually did an album of covers called 11, with 11 covers on it. It was one, I don't really, it wasn't a great album, but it was a good album. But in her career, I saw her many, many times, and she used to play The Who, and she used to play Lou Reed.
She played with Lou Reed. How many times did I see her play with Lou Reed?
But when she when she was touring by herself, you know, as part of the Patti Smith group, she'd play songs, and they were part of her. But she never recorded them. You'd only get them on bootlegs, on the live sets, and so some live bootlegs. So I have like five versions of
recorded with a realistic tape recorder.
Yeah,
but you know, you made a statement, and I'm going to disagree with you. I think that even a young band has an opportunity to connect across, you know, different musical types by somehow throwing in that song that they heard with their parents or they heard some other way, and it's just, oh, that was interesting. I never expected them to play that.
Well, and you mentioned the Stones being a cover, and the Beatles were also a cover band, and they did Twist and Shout. And they toured with Little Richard, and Little Richard actually, they did a lot of his songs in concert. And it was only in the early albums have a number of covers that they recorded. But I was going to mention Susie Sue and the Banshees did a incredible version of Helter Skelter, which became one of their big hits. And it was an encore, but not as an encore as a favor to play it. You know, it was an encore because
It
was part of their catalog. And so you can do that, and bands do that, you know, often. Will find a cover that they do so well that
it's part of their performance.
Right.
It's part of their repertoire, as they say.
But we seem to have lost a lot of that. I feel sad because I like to hear other people's take on other people's songs.
So maybe we should start a cover band. What do you say, Brandley?
Well, you know, and it may be happening, but I'll be honest with you. I mean, I'm pretty well stuck in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. unless my son comes up and goes, Dad, listen to this. Doesn't that sound
good? Was there music in the 90s? That's what I want to know.
It was all electronic, though. He would say, Dad, listen to this. This is great. And I would say, wow, that's fantastic. What is it? And he would name this band. And going back to one of our previous podcasts where you mentioned, this music comes from everywhere now.
Yep.
So, you know, it's not that it's not out there. It's just I don't listen to it. You know, AM radio only has so many covers, you know.
Do you have anything other than AM radio in your car?
Oh, yeah.
That's a car that's made in the 50s, right, your car?
No, that car is the
The Super Camry actually has a CD player in it.
Oh, yes. My God.
But
what about, does it have the 8-track? That's what I want to know.
No, the 8-track went out with, I had a Datsun 260 that had an 8-track in it. And actually, I have a home 8-track player
that was my daughter's car, by the way. So
I know.
My 27-year-old daughter's. That's,
which now has 287,000 miles on it.
Wow. We'll have to cut this part out of the...
We're over time anyhow, so I'm just I like to put a little bit of ramble at the end
here. Okay, so we're good.
As I fade it down, I can say, well, join us next week, and
as we ramble,
you'll hear Lenny say,
ramble on!
Oh, well, I like that part. That's sort of a Fire Sign Theater moment. We, you know, we're...